Well, thank you very much, and welcome to the debate that never was. Sorry about that. I've come to Memphis where sightings of Elvis are more common than sightings of my debate opponent, apparently. And I feel like, as a debater, like that statement puts it, all dressed up and nowhere to go. So what do you do when you have a debate and there's only one side talking? I'm going to try to do my best for you tonight to expand on the remarks that I would have been using in my presentation in the debate, and then in the place of answering my opponent, Dr. Michael Martin, I'll take his book, Atheism, A Philosophical Justification, and try to cross-examine it and offer something of what I'm sure you would have heard if he had been here anyway. It just won't be quite as entertaining, I guess, without having both of us here. The questions that you have as I am lecturing, I would really welcome to be written on the cards that have been distributed so that after we have a brief break, I'll have an opportunity to interact with what you'd like to talk about and hopefully scratch where you itch intellectually. I've come to you this evening because I think when a person takes a public and a published position on an issue as momentous in its consequences as the existence or the non-existence of God, it is expected that he will stand up and give an account of his reasoning. The truth regarding an omnipotent personal creator is an objective public matter, and those who disagree over it, theists and atheists, should be willing and able to answer for the view to which they are committed. They should expect vigorous cross-examination to see if their views will withstand scrutiny. They should want anybody who wishes to do so to be able to check the public record of their debate to assess for themselves which side has the more cogent defense. And thus, as a Christian theist, I appreciate the opportunity to make a public case in favor of the truth of my faith. I regret that my opponent did not share these commitments or confidence in the public defensibility of his atheistic position, but more on that later. You know what I think would really be an interesting debate topic? I'd love to see two scholars come out here and debate the existence of air. That's what I'd like to see. That would be downright fascinating. Just think of it, profound and articulate argumentation, cross-examination over whether air is real. All the while, the two disputants breathing air in and out as they puff and puff their arguments at each other. That'd be rather silly, wouldn't it? We're debating the existence of air while we are, in fact, breathing air as a precondition of our ability to debate. And I think it would be silly as a scholarly exercise for a person who offers erudite arguments against the existence of air to pursue that project as though air didn't exist when, in fact, contrary to his conclusions, he's using air all along. He would, in that case, be a living contradiction, since his argumentation would be possible. His argument would be possible only if his argument were wrong. I want you to think about that for a minute. He could argue against the existence of air, all the while breathing air, only if his argument proved to be wrong. And I believe that that is something of an illustration, a good illustration, of what is so wrong with a scholar trying to debate and show that God does not exist. He may argue this way, he may argue that way, he may enlist profound lines of erudite reasoning, but because the validity of what is assumed and the validity of what is utilized in debate, that is the cogency of logic, the cogency of language, objective knowledge, and a number of other things we'll mention this evening, since the validity of those things, which are assumed in debate, only makes sense within the theistic worldview, the atheist debater is like the man who, while continuing to breathe, argues that air does not exist. The existence of God is rationally necessary to rationality, to science, and to ethics. in which case the atheist must secretly take for granted the very thing he hopes to refute in order to engage in the debate at all. By participating in the debate, he has, in principle, already lost the debate. And this is what I would have liked to have said to Dr. Martin if he had been here this evening, that by coming to the debate, you've lost. Because debate itself presupposes things which are only intelligible within a theistic worldview, particularly, in my case, I would maintain the Christian theistic worldview. In Acts, the 17th chapter, the Apostle Paul said to the philosophers of Athens that in God we live and move and have our being. God is, to speak metaphorically, the intellectual atmosphere that we breathe whenever we attempt to be rational or logical, whenever we attempt to use language or to learn things scientifically. Any attempt then to rationally disprove God would in itself undermine the very rationality which the debater utilized. Philosophically, depending upon the theistic worldview, again, without admitting it any more than the person who argues against air admits that he's breathing, philosophically, depending upon the theistic worldview, he pursues the futile errand of demonstrating that atheism is true instead. And I'd like to explain that to you this evening. Years ago, Aristotle wrote that man by nature desires to know, that that's part of our human nature. We all want to be able to know. Philosophy pursues the systematic and the self-critical maturation and fulfillment of that desire to know. And it's my conviction that atheism as a philosophy makes it impossible to achieve this goal of knowing what we all do in fact know. Human beings seek to understand themselves and seek to understand the world in which they live. They seek to explain things, to make their experience intelligible in terms of some larger context than isolated and momentary sensations. With knowledge, they gain a measure of control over their environment, and that enables them to make life more comfortable and safe, more successful and personally satisfying. As a person becomes more intellectually mature, he brings discipline now to the study of whatever aspect of experience fascinates or interests him. He seeks greater precision in description, greater clarity in conceptualization, coherence between the various kinds of explanation he offers for the different aspects of his experience. As we might say, he attempts to become more scientific through the development of systematic and general laws in terms of which experience is conceptually and causally explainable, and to some degree predictable. But this scientific level of thinking, disciplined, systematic approach to various aspects of experience, this scientific level of thinking is never an end for human inquiry. And that's because questions will inevitably arise about the nature and the extent and the assumptions of science, and particularly questions about the relationship between the different sciences, say, between physics and psychology and history and grammar and on and on. And this brings us unavoidably then to philosophical reflection. Philosophy is concerned with the presuppositions and the conceptual muddles which arise in any and all fields of study, rather than being about some separate area of human experience. Philosophy also seeks a world and life view in terms of which all of the elements of human experience and the various ways in which they are explained or made intelligible can be unified into a coherent outlook. To put it simply, philosophy has a critical function on the one hand, as well as a constructive function on the other. And I'd like to quote one of my favorite philosophers, Bertrand Russell, in this regard. In 1924, in contemporary British philosophy, in an article entitled Logical Atomism, Russell wrote, "The business of philosophy, as I conceive it, is essentially that of logical analysis, followed by logical synthesis. Comprehensive construction is part of the business of philosophy. But I believe that the most important part, to my mind, consists in criticizing and clarifying notions which are apt to be regarded as fundamental and accepted uncritically." And so here we have somebody, a notorious atheist, who would endorse basically the platform on which I'm standing as I begin my lecture and presentation tonight. Philosophy is inevitable, and philosophy has two sides to it: critical cross-examination and the attempt to constructively bring together a unified picture of reality. The philosopher needs to question and cross-examine claims to the truth and efforts at explanation. Socrates put it best years ago when he said, "The unexamined life is not worth living." Philosophy seeks clarity and conceptual cogency, and it seeks well-grounded claims. On the other hand, philosophy is not satisfied to have bits and pieces of knowledge in various fields of study, or even widespread regions of human experience, left to be loose and disjointed without any intelligible relationship to each other. The philosopher seeks an overall picture of reality which gives a proper place to every detail of man's experience and knowledge. His quest is to develop an adequate worldview and corresponding philosophy of life. Philosophy forces us to face fundamental, conceptual, and systematically basic questions about the nature of reality, how we know what we know, and how men ought to behave. Just to give a very brief sampling to survey some of the major questions a philosopher has to ask. Philosophy asks, first of all, what are the ultimate principles by which we answer philosophical questions about reality, about knowledge, and about ethics? What are those ultimate principles? What are the principles that render experience intelligible and explain, predict, or control things? Are those principles organized? Are they logically consistent? Are they explicatable in language? Are they justifiable, or are they arbitrary? Secondly, when a philosopher tries to bring together a worldview, he's going to have to ask, how should we understand nature? Questions about matter and motion. Is there an underlying unity or identity through change in the way things appear in this world? Is there an objective order in the world? And if it is objectively ordered, is it a mechanical order or a purposeful, teleological order? Thirdly, philosophers ask questions like, what is man's place and function in the universe? What is his special dignity, if any? And what is the meaning of life? How do values fit into the realm of nature? Are values objective, and by what standard should men live? And fourthly, philosophers ask, is man's mind self-sufficient? Is reason an instrument for obtaining objective knowledge of reality? Should man follow his sense perceptions, his observations, or should men follow their rational conceptions and various kinds of coherence that they bring to experience? How do sense perceptions and rational conceptions relate to each other? Now, everyone utilizes some network of presuppositions regarding these matters. I realize that will surprise many of you because you're sitting there thinking, I've never in my life thought such a thing. That question has never been put to me in that way. I've never come up with it that way. But that's not my point. I'm just trying to be precise and to the point when I utter the questions with that kind of technical language. My point is that all of us have views on these matters. In fact, it's inevitable that we're going to have views. We live in terms of those views. Everyone utilizes a network of presuppositions regarding questions like these, although for most people, It is a network of presuppositions that is implicit rather than explicit, unclear rather than precise, and poorly developed rather than well thought out. Philosophy forces a critical investigation of differing worldviews. And yet, for all of that, it more often than not fails to reach unanimity of opinion. Why? Why is it that philosophers who are supposed to be so intelligent, so precise, so critically minded, why don't they come to agreement on these basic issues? The reason why philosophical disputes tend to be so difficult to resolve is that there are profound differences between the worldviews of those who are party to the disputes in philosophy, and particularly to those who are party to a dispute over whether God exists or doesn't. Those worldviews will control the way in which factual evidence is accepted and interpreted, and thus they are not resolvable, these disputes between worldviews. They are not resolvable by simply looking and seeing what we observe about the world and deciding who's right and who's wrong. You may be able to decide who's right about the price of eggs at the market by driving down there and looking and seeing, but you cannot solve fundamental philosophical questions in that way. Conflicting presuppositions about reality, about knowledge, and about ethics determine what a person takes to be problematic, what's in need of explanation. They determine what can be taken for granted about experience and reality, that is, what is initially certain as we begin to reason. They determine what the nature of an adequate analysis or explanation or argument would be. That is to say, conflicting worldviews will focus on different problems. They'll have different starting points, and they'll pursue different methods and standards. It's little surprise, therefore, that adherents of different worldviews argue past each other and come to radically conflicting conclusions. And in light of these introductory remarks, any intelligent, any fruitful debate over the philosophical question of the existence of God will come down in the final analysis to an assessment of conflicting worldviews, the worldviews of the atheist and the theist. This is not a matter of saying, okay, now we've gone to the market, we've found the egg counter, and we're going to look at what the posted price is. So you see, get two people in a room, and we've now come into this room, and we're going to look at the egg counter and say, now, is God there or not? It just doesn't work that way. We have to understand that the debate between the theist and the atheist is a debate over broader philosophical issues. In fact, a debate over entire worldviews. In the end, the issue is whether the underlying philosophy regarding reality, knowledge, and ethics to which either party is committed is cogent, is consistent, and warranted. In particular, we must ask whether atheism or theism as worldviews can provide the preconditions for making human experience intelligible, or whether they leave logic and science and ethics arbitrary and or incoherent. Let me put that to you again for those taking notes. We have to finally ask whether atheism or theism provide the preconditions for making human experience intelligible, or whether they leave science, logic, and ethics to be arbitrary and or incoherent. And it's just because the atheist worldview of Michael Martin undermines rationality and morality that it is philosophically unacceptable. What we all take for granted in terms of objective knowledge, linguistic meaningfulness, logical standards, scientific procedures, human freedom and dignity, and moral absolutes. Because what we take for granted in terms of these things would become utterly unintelligible within the context of the atheist worldview, because they do not comport with atheist assumptions. When the atheist tells us there is no God, that what we have is matter in motion, all of a sudden it becomes impossible to give a rational account of objectivity, human freedom, moral absolutes, linguistic meaning, logical standards, and scientific procedures. And that is the crucial defect, you see. Atheism is its own worst enemy in terms of debating. On the other hand, the worldview of Christian theism, I believe, is the philosophical perspective in which all of these things are simultaneously intelligible. It's the philosophical context within which they individually and together make sense. And therefore, the atheist who attempts to use language and logic to support, in any scientific fashion, the refutation of theism is assuming the very thing he's aiming to refute, though he hides that from himself. He's like the man who argues there is no air, all the while breathing. To use the words of Cornelius Van Til, to put it real simply, anti-theism presupposes theism. Anti-theism, in order to be intelligible, presupposes theism. I can state my case briefly, and I'll come right to the point. The proof of Christian theism, which I offer you tonight, is this: that in terms of philosophical worldviews, without Christian theism, you cannot prove anything. The proof of Christian theism is that without that worldview, you cannot prove anything. And that's because the atheistic worldview, say of a Michael Martin, does not comport with the concepts and the principles of logic, science, language, human freedom, and moral obligation. In which case, it cannot prove or so much as give an account of knowing anything whatsoever. Atheism intellectually fails as a worldview and thus profoundly refutes itself. The point here is not merely that the atheist cannot show that he knows God doesn't exist. My point is really much more fundamental. It's that he cannot show that he knows anything whatsoever in terms of a broader philosophical theory which could justify those claims. Consequently, you will find the persistent response of atheists to their inability to advance a systematic philosophy in the style of a Plato or an Aristotle or whoever. You'll find that consistently the response of atheists to their failure to develop a systematic philosophy, their failure to devise a credible, coherent worldview regarding reality, knowledge, and ethics, is simply to dismiss the question of worldviews and pretend it's unimportant or somehow inaccessible. That is to say, what I'm not able to do well is not important. And so if there's some kind of philosophical demand on me to develop a worldview in which I can make sense of my argumentation, then so much the worse for the demand for a worldview. Because the one thing the atheist knows for certain to begin with, not at the end of the investigation, but at the beginning, is that God is not going to be allowed to exist. And so if I need the existence of God to make sense of my argument, if I need that for a credible worldview, then it'd be better just to say we don't need worldviews. And of course, all of philosophy in the late 20th century is pretty much infected with this kind of disease. The big questions will no longer be considered. It's either somehow incoherent or without meaning to talk about them, or answers are not accessible. And so whatever's not accessible can't be important. It's kind of like the man who says, whatever my net doesn't catch can't be fish. Anything that I can't get hold of and control can't be important. And so atheists will just kind of, you know, run off and say, that's not important, we don't need a worldview. But it's just because the atheist worldview is self-refuting and undermines the intelligibility of rationality, objectivity, moral absolutes, science, human dignity, and freedom, that the atheist worldview makes it impossible to argue for the atheist worldview. The point is not merely, then, that the atheist cannot show that he knows God doesn't exist. My point is more broadly, the atheist can't show that he knows anything. And yet atheists are very intelligent people. I want to make very clear that I'm not here standing to tell you atheists are not brilliant men. I think Michael Martin is a very intelligent man, a very hard-working scholar. See, I pay attention to his books. I wouldn't do that if I didn't believe that and have that kind of respect for him. On the other hand, I don't believe that atheists understand themselves as well as they think. And that though they reject the existence of God outwardly by profession, the only way in which they can make sense of their rational procedures at all is to secretly depend upon that worldview anyway. Let me again quote Dr. Van Til. Christianity can be shown to be not just as good as, or even better than, the non-Christian position, but the only position that does not make nonsense of human experience. Only in the context of the Christian worldview can we give an account of math, give an account of history, an account of literature, an account of science, an account of industry, civil government, and every other aspect or facet of human experience. And this is why we say that God has made his existence and his character abundantly clear to all men. The evidence for God's existence is pervasive and inescapable, since God is the precondition for the intelligibility of man's experience and man's reasoning. Those who deny God render their thinking futile and foolish in terms of the need for a critically minded philosophical worldview. The same challenge to unbelief was issued in the ancient world by the Apostle Paul, who wrote, "Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age?" That is more poignancy tonight. Where is the debater of this age? "Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world?" Paul wrote to the Colossians in chapter 2 of that epistle, "In Christ are deposited all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. In which case those whose philosophy is not according to Christ, but rather according to the elements of human speculation, will be robbed of knowledge. They'll be robbed of the ability to justify their truth claims." These are the things that the apostle wrote years ago. And that theme in the Apostle Paul echoes the Old Testament book of Proverbs, which teaches us at the very outset that the beginning of knowledge is the fear of the Lord, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. The fear of the Lord is the head. It's the beginning, the most important point in knowing anything. David thus wrote in the Psalms, "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God." Atheism is intellectually indefensible because as a worldview, it would make it impossible, if one is consistent, to justify any claims to knowledge, whether they're religious claims or mundane claims, whether they're about transcendent matters or the details of ordinary life. And I'd like to illustrate this point from the history of philosophy tonight, taking four major illustrations. I want to consider briefly a few noteworthy philosophers who, in at least rough approximation, shared Dr. Martin's affiliation with something like logical positivism. If you look at chapter 2 of his book, Atheism, A Philosophical Justification, you see that he's willing to hold on to this school of thought. He thinks that it hasn't been as discredited as many philosophers would tell you today. And so I'm going to look at four philosophers who were not, strictly speaking, logical positivists, but had many similar themes and commitments in their approach to philosophy. What is distinctive for our purposes here is their commitment to a rigorously empirical theory of knowledge, a theory of knowledge that is tied to observation or perception, and a corresponding rejection of God's existence, or at least the rejection of any cognitive, factual knowledge of God's existence. The attempt to develop this kind of outlook, rigorously empirical, anti-transcendent, The attempt to develop that kind of outlook has always proved unsuccessful in the history of philosophy, and even worse, it has proved self-refuting. And we can quickly survey the philosophical inadequacy of such an approach if we look at Epicurus in the ancient world, David Hume, Bertrand Russell, and Ludwig Wittgenstein. Let me begin with Epicurus. He was born about 341 BC and was a materialistic atomist in his theory of reality and a qualitative hedonist in his ethical philosophy of living. Epicurus held that philosophical methods should begin with the plain facts of sense perception and shape all opinions in terms of sense perception, augmented by the demand for non-contradiction. So, sensation and logic. According to him, following Democritus earlier, there is no such thing as spiritual reality, for reality is composed of an infinite number of qualitatively identical and self-propelling atoms whose arrangement and whose ceaseless motion explain the qualities of things and the behavior that we observe in the objects of this world. Everything that exists, according to Epicurus, even the gods, even the human soul, was explained materially and naturalistically. There was thus, he said, nothing to fear in death, and man should now live for the happiness or pleasure of tranquility. That was a quite popular philosophy in its day, it's popular in our day, but it's hardly a cogent philosophy upon cross-examination. Let's begin with this. The premise that all knowledge is perceptual in nature was not one which Epicurus knew on the basis of perception itself. And thus his philosophy refuted itself. Everything we know is based on perception. The question is, do you know that based on perception? And of course, there is no perception from which one could bring about that conclusion. Moreover, what Epicurus said about reality could not possibly have been known by means of perception. That is, he believed in the existence of imperceptibly small bits of matter. Well, he didn't know that by perception. He believed the number of those bits of matter to be infinite. No one has infinite perceptual knowledge, and that they were all in ceaseless motion. How could he know, unless he was watching them all the time, that those infinite bits of matter were in ceaseless motion? You see, on the one hand, he wanted to be strictly empirical, but that strict empiricism undermined what he wanted to say about reality. His naturalistic atomistic theory of reality could not credibly explain man as having free will, since man is nothing but the mechanical combination of atoms falling through empty space. Epicurus himself offered the ad hoc and arbitrary theory that there must have been a swerve in the fall of these atoms, which accounts for man's unpredictability, what we call man's will. So the atoms are falling through space, man is just a mechanical combination of these atoms falling through space, and for some reason, this is what makes it arbitrary and ad hoc, the atoms, one atom swerved, and then there's all this billiard ball effect, and that's what brings unpredictability, and unpredictability is what we call human will. But of course, even that deprives man of purposeful choice, and leaves us with the conclusion that since what our brains devise is mechanically determined, or at times unexplicable due to swerves in the atoms, we have no basis for trusting our reasoning, or that our reasoning has anything to do with an objective realm of truth. If we cannot help thinking what we do, why bother with philosophical investigation? Why bother debating at all? Given problems with his theory of knowledge, how could Epicurus know that there was no afterlife? So that was a major premise of his ethical philosophy. But given his epistemological difficulties, the theory of knowledge, he couldn't say, he couldn't give any basis for his ethic. And what sense could he make of man having any ethical obligation whatsoever, much less the ethical obligation to seek the pleasure of tranquility? You see, Epicurus shows us that that approach to philosophy becomes nothing more than a subjective choice. Of course, as we've seen, his philosophy can't account for man making any choices either. So, I mean, it's got problems upon problems. The empiricism and atheism of Epicurus were completely inadequate to give an account of or to make possible rationality, objectivity, man's freedom, and moral absolutes. Let's turn to a second example. The Scottish skeptic David Hume, born in 1711, faced a similar plight due to his exclusively empirical method and his anti-metaphysical prejudices. Hume advanced a strictly empirical criterion of meaning. Let me quote him from an inquiry concerning human understanding. Hume said, "When we entertain, therefore, any suspicion that a philosophical term is employed without any meaning or idea, as is but too frequent, we need but inquire from what impression is that supposed idea derived." That kind of rigor, felt Hume, would lead us to take in hand, and I quote, any volume of divinity or school metaphysics and ask, does it contain any abstract reasoning concerning quantity or number? No. Does it contain any experimental reasoning concerning matter of fact and existence? No. Commit it then to the flames, for it can contain nothing but sophistry and illusion. Now, Dr. Martin would be pleased. But a more cautious philosopher will note the outcome of a consistent application of Hume's empirical method, from which Hume, unlike many modern disciples of Hume, did not flinch, namely, that our common philosophical notions, for all their traditional use and importance, proved to be not merely false, but nonsensical as well. Let me illustrate. For instance, we have no empirical impression of any underlying identity through change, either in the supposed objects of the external world or in ourselves as the subject of these impressions. There's nothing but temporal succession of one sensation after another. And there is no meaningful basis then for speaking of continuous objects of experience, nor any meaning.